to live in love of action, and to let live in understanding of the other's will, is the fundamental maxim of free human beings. They know no other should than the one with which their willing is intuitively in harmony. Their capacity for ideas tells them how they are to will in any given case. If the basic source of compatibility did not lie within human nature, we could not implant it by any outward laws. Only because individuals are of one spirit can they live out their lives side by side. A free person lives in trust that the other free person belongs to the same spiritual world and that they will concur with each other in their intentions. Those who are free demand no agreement from their fellows, but they expect it because it is inherent in human nature. This is not meant to indicate the necessity of this or that outer arrangement. Rather, it is meant to indicate the attitude, the state of the soul, with which a human being, experiencing himself or herself amidst esteemed fellow human beings, can best do justice to human dignity. There are many who will object. The concept of the free human being that you sketch is a chimera. It has been realized nowhere. We have to deal with real people, and the only morality to hope for in them comes when human beings obey an ethical commandment, when they formulate their ethical tasks as duty, and do not freely allow their inclinations and their love, I do not doubt this at all. Only a blind man could. But if this is supposed to be the final insight, then away with all hypocrisy about ethics. You should then simply say that as long as human nature is not free, it must be forced into action. From a certain standpoint, it is irrelevant whether unfreedom is enforced through physical means or through moral laws, whether humans are unfree because they obey their limitless sexual drive or because they are enchained by conventional morality. But let us not claim that people can correctly call their actions their own, if they are driven to them by a power other than themselves. Still, right in the midst of compulsion, certain human beings lift themselves up, free spirits, who in the welter of custom, legal stricture, religious practice, and so forth, find themselves. They are free, to the extent that they obey only themselves. They are unfree, to the extent that they subject themselves to something else. Who of us can say that they are really free in all their actions? But in each of us there dwells a deeper being in whom the free human comes to expression. Our life is made up of free and unfree actions. Yet we cannot think the concept of the human through to the end without arriving at the free spirit as the purest expression of human nature. Indeed, we are only truly human to the extent that we are free. That is an ideal, many will say. No doubt. But it is an ideal that works as a real element in our being and manifests in its effects on the surface. It is no thought-up or dreamed-up ideal, but one that has life and makes itself clearly known in even its most imperfect form of existence. Were human beings merely natural creatures, it would be absurd to look for ideals, that is, ideas that are not currently effective and requiring realization. With things of the external world, the idea is determined by the percept, and we have done our part once we have recognized the connection between idea and percept. But this is not so with humans. The totality of human existence is not determined apart from the human beings themselves. Their true concepts as ethical human beings, free spirits, are not united in advance, objectively, with the perceptual picture of human beings, needing merely to be confirmed afterward by cognition. As human beings, we must each unite our own concept with the percept of human through our own activity. Concept and percept coincide here only if we ourselves make them coincide. But we can do so only if we have discovered the concept of the free spirit, which is our own concept. In the objective world, the percept is divided from the concept by the way we are organized. In cognition, we overcome this division. The division is no less present in our subjective nature. We overcome it in the course of our development by bringing our own concept to full outward manifestation. Thus the intellectual, as well as the moral life of human beings, lead us to the dual nature of humans, perceiving, immediate experience, and thinking. This is the dual nature, perceiving and thinking. Intellectual life overcomes the duality through cognition. Moral life overcomes it through the actual realization of the free spirit. Every being has its inborn concept, the law of its being and activity. But in external things, the concept is inseparably bound up with the percept and only separated from it in our spiritual organism. In human beings, the concept and the percept are actually separate at first, to be just as actually united by human beings themselves. It could be objected that a particular concept corresponds to our percept of a human being at every instant of a person's life, just as it does to every other thing, that I can create the concept of a stereotypical human for myself and can also have such a human given me as percept. Were I then to add to that the concept of the free spirit, I would have two concepts for one and the same object. This is one-sided thinking. As a perceptual object, I am subject to continual transformation. As a child, I was one thing, as a youth, another, as an adult, still another. In fact, at every moment, the perceptual picture of myself is different from what it was a moment before. These changes can take place in such a way that the same person, the stereotypical human, is always expressed in them or in such a way that they represent the expression of the free spirit. My actions, too, as objects of perception, are subject to such changes. There is a possibility for the human perceptual object to transform itself, just as within the plant seed there lies the possibility of becoming a whole plant. The plant will transform itself because of the objective lawfulness lying within it. Humans remain in an incomplete state if they do not take in hand the transformative substance within themselves and transform themselves through their own power. Nature makes human beings merely natural creatures. Society makes them law-abiding actors. But they can only make themselves into free beings. At a certain stage of their development, nature releases human beings from her chains. Society carries this development up to a further point. But human beings must give themselves the final polish. The standpoint of free morality does not claim that the free spirit is the only form in which a human being can exist. Free morality sees in free spirituality only the final stage of human evolution. This is not to deny that acting in accordance with norms has its justification as one stage of evolution, but it cannot be acknowledged as the absolute standpoint of morality. The free spirit overcomes such norms, in that free spirits do not merely feel commandments as motives, but order their actions according to their impulses, intuitions. Kant says, "Duty, you exalted mighty name, you who contain nothing lovable, nothing ingratiatingly agreeable, but who demand submission, you who establish a law before which all inclinations fall dumb, though in secret they may work against it." Unquote. This is from his Critique of Practical Reason. Duty it started with. To this a human being out of the consciousness of the free spirit replies, quote, "Freedom, you friendly human name, you who contain everything morally beloved, everything that most dignifies my humanity, and who make me into no one's servant, you who do not merely establish a law, but wait for what my moral love itself will recognize as law, because it feels unfree in the face of every merely imposed law." Unquote. This is the contrast between morality that is merely lawful and morality that is free. Philistines, who see morality embodied in something externally fixed, might even see a free spirit as a dangerous person. They will do so, however, only because their view is limited to a particular epoch. But if they could look beyond it, they would immediately find that free spirits need to move beyond the laws of the state as little as the Philistines themselves, and that they never have to place themselves in real opposition to these laws. For the laws of the state, like all other objectively ethical laws, all sprang from the intuitions of free spirits. There is no law enforced by family authority that was not once intuitively conceived and formulated as such by an ancestor. Even the conventional laws of morality are first established by specific persons, and the laws of the state always arise in the heads of state officials. These minds have set up laws over other people, and no one becomes unfree except by forgetting that origin and making the laws either into extra-human commandments, into objective ethical concepts of duty independent of human participation, or into the commanding voice of one's own falsely conceived, mystically compelling inner self. But those who do not overlook the origin, but seek the human being within it, will see it as belonging to the same world of ideas from which they too draw their moral intuitions. If they believe that they have better intuitions, then they try to substitute their own for the existing ones. If they find that the existing ones are justified, then they act in accordance with them as if they were their own. We must not establish the formula that human beings exist to realize an ethical world order cut off from themselves. Anyone who claimed as much would still be standing, in relation to the science of humankind, at the same point at which natural science stood when it believed that a bull has horns in order to butt. Fortunately, natural sciences scientists have done away with such concepts of purpose. It is harder for ethics, similarly, to free itself. But just as horns do not exist because of butting, but butting exists through the horns, so human beings do not exist because of morality, but morality exists through human beings. Free human beings act morally because they have moral ideas. But they do not act in order for morality to arise. Human individuals with the moral ideas belonging to their being are the precondition for the moral world order. The human individual is the source of all morality and the center of earthly life. States and societies exist because they turn out to be the necessary consequences of individual life. That states and societies then react upon individual life is just as understandable as the fact that butting, which exists because of the bull's horns, reacts upon the further development of the horns, which would otherwise become stunted with prolonged disuse. In the same way, humans would become stunted if they led isolated existences outside human community. It is precisely for this that the social order is formed, so that it can then react favorably on the individual.